Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. And hello there, Chris Vandercook.
Hey, how are you, Beth Ann?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
Pretty good. The issue of who cares for older relatives is one that's going to grow and grow because we're all living longer, right?
Especially here.
Yeah.
And it's why Hawaii may be a model for what the rest of the country may be able to scale if we see certain legislation happen this time around or happen soon. Now, in Hawaii, there are 154,000 unpaid family caregivers. That number comes from AARP. And according to the group, the caregivers are most likely women in the workforce caring for parents or an older spouse. This session, companion bills to offer more support to family caregivers would provide a respite stipend of $70 per day if the appropriation is approved by the legislature. The Senate version, HB 534, will be considered by the House on Friday. Social activist Ai Jen Poo is the spring 2017 Dan and Maggie Inouye Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals, and she's back with us today. Good morning. Aloha. Thank you for being here.
Aloha. It's great to be with you again.
When we have talked in past about where we are as a state, moving to having more people who are living longer, living healthier, but there's also the downside of that, which means that somebody has got to be caring for them. That spawned businesses. It spawned all kinds of consultants and some sort of care that you pay for. The problem is in paying for it. In part, these bills would assist with some hours paid for during the day. Is that going to be where at least you see us, starting to get our feet wet a little bit to understand that we're going to have a coalition of people and government has a role in this too?
Absolutely. By the year 2020, there will be 300,000 people in Hawaii over the age of 65. And many of us are already living in multi-generational households, so we know that that's the case. And we don't have any infrastructure in place to support families who want to support their older loved ones who are living longer than ever before to live well at home. Most of us would much prefer to stay at home with our families in our communities, and it's a difficult and often isolating experience to try to do that. And the Kupuna Caregiver Program that is being discussed in the legislature right now is a breakthrough program that actually invests in families to be able to care for their loved ones at home. So it's a role for government, absolutely, but it's really about enhancing the role of families.
We talk about families as being under so much stress from so many different areas, and that's not just a personal or a family issue. It's also an economic issue. And in terms of economics, it's also played into the reason why we've heard that it's better to have an elder age at home, and there's been such a push to have elders aging in place, all of that together. And yet there hasn't been quite yet the kind of support for families and well as employers to know that, that stress is being, if not evenly distributed, at least distributed among several different organizations and groups.
It's going to have to be. I mean, this is a challenge that the whole country is going to have to grapple with. There are enormous implications for productivity in terms of all the adult age working people who are struggling with making impossible choices around caring for their parents and their kids and going to work every day. And then you have an economy with unprecedented levels of inequality where 75% of our workforce in this country earns less than $50,000 per year. So with that kind of income, how in the world are you supposed to afford the care you need without assistance? And that's the spirit of this Kupuna Caregiver Program. Right now, as it stands, something happens like grandma falls and ends up in the hospital, rather than it being a temporary moment of where the family comes together and then is able to grapple with it and then actually solve the challenge together and move on. It becomes oftentimes a permanent crisis. And what the program would do would actually just support families to be more resilient. And it's just the beginning of what we need for the whole country. And Hawaii just happens to be ahead of the curve on this.
In part because we have a different cultural ethic?
I think that's a huge part of it. I mean, there is an There is a clear and fundamental cultural difference here. When I come to Hawaii and I talk to people in the legislature, it is a no-brainer that we have to care for our kapuna, and that it is not a burden. It is not. It is actually something that we all want to do, because our kapuna are an incredibly integral part of our family life and our community here, and we honor our elders in Hawaii. Now, in the rest of the country, I have a huge challenge. Our whole movement has a huge challenge in really turning their attention towards what older people need to live well and with dignity.
Ijen, is that because they're simply in denial about this? They don't have the same sensitivities that we have here, or because they're just so spread out, they haven't had the kind of interaction with their elders that many of us are lucky enough to have here?
I think it's a little of both. I also think that caregiving issues have historically been kind of seen as personal, private matters that we deal with behind closed doors, sometimes at the dinner table, but never really seen and often associated with women, right? That women will just handle it. And we can no longer make that assumption. Right now, 75% of children in the United States are living in households where all the adults work outside the home. So there's no longer a kind of default care infrastructure that we culturally have assumed, where women would stay home and take care of the parents and take care of the kids. It just doesn't exist anymore, and our culture hasn't caught up.
So given the fact that we are dealing with this disconnect of reality to what expectations may have been, what has to happen in the rest of the country to, in a way, make them more consistent with what's happening in Hawaii?
Well, in some ways, Hawaii has the opportunity to really take the first step and have a proof of concept for the rest of the country. And there are many states that are watching. There are really active campaigns in Maine, in Michigan, in Ohio, in North Carolina, in Minnesota, in Washington State, where they're beginning to grapple with this question. And legislative champions are emerging, and they're all watching this Kapuna Caregiver Program in the Hawaii legislature, because it would be the first of its kind in the country where we're really investing in family caregivers.
Family caregiving extends beyond just elders. You mentioned that a moment ago about what our expectations used to be, that a woman would stay home to take care of both little kids and elders. But we know that the world has fundamentally changed. In that change, as you mentioned, that this is just the beginning, where do you see this going in terms of embracing all of the kind of caregiving that has to happen as we try to reconcile our need for families with our necessity of work?
I think in the 21st century, we have to rethink how we organize work, family, and the economy to actually account for the fact that people need to take care of their families as they work. And what I mean by that is we often think about infrastructure as like the roads and bridges and tunnels that create that make commerce possible. And I would argue that a new care infrastructure is necessary in order to make the 21st century economy sustainable and create real opportunity and equality for everyone. And how I think we get there is through the idea that every single family should have the support they need to take care of their children, to take paid family leave when they need to, and to take care of their elders. And so we have a vision for a program called Universal Family Care, which is one program that we all contribute to and we can all draw from to help us afford childcare, elder care, and paid leave when we need it. And that is an infrastructure investment to me. It is a kind of investment that we all make and we all benefit from that also enables the rest of the economy to function in a more sustainable way in the 21st century.
You talk about a system that would allow all of us to contribute as well as to take from it. And in so doing, do you say then that we might have a situation where, for example, we get a paycheck every couple of weeks and a few dollars from that might be spirited away, popped into this fund, and at some point we might also be able to draw from it as well as having appropriations from government?
Absolutely. I think that we need to be able to, whether it's coming out of a paycheck or some other way that we're all contributing, I think we're going to need to pilot in a few states to see how a program like this could work, and we're talking about that in Maine and Michigan. But the idea being, like the way that social insurance, some of our best social programs have been social insurance programs like Social Security and Medicare, where we're all contributing and then we're all able to benefit when we need it. Those programs work, right? And they work best when the pool is larger, when we're all sharing the risk. And in a program for family care, it affects everyone, and everyone needs it. So it would be the largest pool imaginable here. We think that there's a way to structure it to be sustainable and to really support all families. And we'll just need to do some innovation to figure out exactly what will work best.
When you say the system that we'd all be contributing to, would that be state by state? Would it be a federal program?
Long term, I think it has to be federal. But in the meantime, states can take a lead and model, like the Kapuna Caregiver Program is going to model long-term care support for family caregivers. I think we need states to also model universal family care programs at the state level so that we can learn and also gather the data we need for a federal solution.
Given the fact that we are in a very changed political climate now than maybe you might have envisioned a year ago, do you have any sort of timeline in your mind as to when you think this might actually be a reality?
Well, I know that voters are already in motion in several states around the country for universal family care and for long-term care programs like the Kapuna Caregiver Program. I think Hawaii is poised to be the breakthrough state, the model on long-term care. And so if that happens, we have proof of concept for the rest of the country. And so I'm optimistic that this issue is rising in saliency as we speak among voters who are really feeling a lot of pain in this economy. And I think that it can be something that not only helps families, but helps us energize people to participate in our democracy.
Ai-Jen Poo, thank you so much for the time today.
Thank you.
Ai-Jen Poo is the University of Hawaii at Manoa Spring 2017 Dan and Maggie Inouye Distinguished Chair in Democratic Ideals. She's also the director of the National Domestic Workers Alliance and will be part of a community panel presentation at the Arts at Mark's Garage tomorrow. And on March 22nd, she will be speaking at the Manoa Art Auditorium. Both events are free and open to the public. Details are on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, understanding the worldwide fascination with orchids. But first, your quiz.
In just a minute, we'll talk about a plant you'd probably like to cultivate. But for today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about one of the most troublesome of invasive plants in Hawaii. It's a fast-growing, weedy tree that can grow to a height of 50 feet. It has especially large leaves that are dark green with a distinctive veiny pattern on their surface. Leaves are green on the top and purple below. The trees produce dark purple seedy fruit, only a third of an inch in diameter. Because the tree grows rapidly and the leaves are so broad, they rob other plants of the sunlight they need to survive. They're an extremely hardy plant, as you might imagine, and it can produce 10 to 20 million seeds a year, seeds that remain viable for 10 or more years. The seeds are tiny and can be spread by animals or unwary hikers who carry them on their boots, unintentionally adding to the environmental threat that they create. Eradication efforts are underway wherever they're found in Hawaii, and this morning we're looking for the name of this flowering pest. You can call us at 941-3689 if you know the answer, or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and get it right, you'll get the prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Orchids are renowned for their spectacular beauty and wide variety as one of the most diverse and widespread families of flowering plants. Their devotees are members of a worldwide subculture for whom no other flowers will do. The best way to understand their fascination and perhaps learn to cultivate them yourself is to attend an orchid show like the one that's coming up weekend after next from the Kunia Orchid Society. Robert Spear is its president, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Bob. Thanks for coming in.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Most of us know that orchids are beautiful and that there are a great many of them, but there's a great deal more about them. I didn't realize, for one thing, that they don't actually grow in soil.
Actually, that's right. There's three different types of orchids, epiphytes, mm-hmm. and which are means they're air plants, and terrestrial, and then a small group called lithophytes, which grow on rocks.
Mm-hmm. How does a plant that grows on a rock, you know, how does it get its nutrients? How does it survive?
Well, from water and from the air and from debris that may be floating around in the air that lands on them or in the trees for the epiphytes.
So that calls for them to be in the right kind of climate to survive, I would think.
The majority of orchids that we know as epiphytes come from the tropical zone, Indonesia, the tropical forests, rainforests, and they grow on trees, most of them, mm-hmm. with their roots hanging down. They attach to the tree but don't get much from the tree.
So they're just they could almost land on any surface, I would think, and survive if the air if the air is damp enough and there's enough rainfall.
That's right, yeah. The rain, is, of course, water is critical for any plant, but orchids as well, and the right kind of mixture is ideal for that. Lighting is also an important thing. Some orchids don't take much direct sunlight. They need to be in the shade and the canopy of a forest, where others have smaller leaves and they can take direct sunlight and do much better with lots of sunlight.
So if you're cultivating orchids at home, you don't really want them in soil, do you?
Absolutely not. Actually, the most of the orchids you can see and buy are in pots. And while they do grow, it's important that they don't get overwatered. That's mm-hmm. the biggest problem for people who kill orchids is, and I've done that, is overwatering mm-hmm. in a mixture in the pot that's too moist.
Why would they be in a pot at all if they don't need it?
Well, convenience for transfer, convenience for growing, that's kind of the way it has developed. And they do okay as long as there's a real airy, big orchid bark mixture inside for most orchids. Mm-hmm. They grow well.
And orchid fanciers love to create new strains, right?
Holy smokes, yes, by the hundreds of thousands. And there are three ways to propagate orchids. One is by pollination. Mm-hmm. It's the most common way. And then there's also cloning, which takes a little bit of the very meristem part, chops it up, and you can get an identical plant from that, as well as taking segments out of a plant that's living division, plant division, and dividing that up into little plants, those produce exactly the same type. Whereas pollination, you may get a million seeds off of one seed pod. Teeny, teeny little things almost look like dust.
Uh-huh.
But every one of those is going to be a little bit different, just like our children with two parents are a little different.
If we had a million children. Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
And so you could take a tiny seed from one strain of orchid, add it to another, or how do you cross pollinate?
Not the seeds that are pollinated, it's the pollen in the mother plant, and crossing two different plants that way to kind of breed them.
So combining their pollen?
In the pollination part of it is where the changes go. And orchids are the most diversely hybridized plant that we have in the world. There's just hundreds of thousands of them. And, you know, anybody can do it. It's real easy to actually cross-pollinate, in most cases, one from another.
So part of the fascination isn't just the beauty of the flowers themselves, but what you can do with them.
Exactly, right. You have so many different things. And, of course, every one has the potential, every new one has the potential to have a new name with it, and tracking those names and so forth is an interesting challenge as well.
So is there a Bob Speer orchid in our future?
No, I have cross-pollinated a few successfully, but I didn't grow it to fruition. Once one of these little seeds comes out, it may take as much as 8 years before mm-hmm. that plant will produce its first flower, so you can see what it looks like. It's not a quick turnover.
Well, but you've got time, right? You got patience.
Yes, we all have time. Yeah. It doesn't matter where you allocate your time.
Yeah. Is there a pretty active orchid growing community here in Hawaii?
You know, very much so. It's part of our culture. As the previous speaker was talking about kapuna care. You know, our culture here is loving orchids. I've been to two different groups here in the last 3 weeks where there were 50 people in each. And I asked the question, does anybody here like orchids? And everybody raised their hands. Mm-hmm. If I did that on the mainland, far fewer would do that. It's part of our ingrained culture of living in Hawaii. We see so many. It's a very good climate to grow orchids. So it's conducive to that beauty. But it's very part of our culture in Hawaii to be knowledgeable and loving orchids.
Well, I'm surprised that you would get that kind of reaction on the mainland, because what's not to like? You know, they're spectacularly beautiful, and it's a very subtle kind of beauty often.
I think people like them. They're just not available to be able to enjoy and propagate in culture.
Yeah. And, of course, we've got the ideal climate for all of that kind of thing. In your annual show, do you see new varieties every year then?
Every year, yes. These shows, it's any novices, it would be really good to join one of the orchid societies. There's 8 or 9 on Oahu, mm-hmm. and each one has a show every year. At our show, there will probably be 10,000 orchids that will be displayed. In the center part, there will be 6 or 8 displays where each display may have 100 or 150 orchids that are blooming, and they're judged and beautiful. It's just incredible to see. But the learning part comes with actually participation, all the orchid shows are really good. And by the way, Windward Orchid Society is having their show this same weekend, March 24th, 25th, and 26th.
You could build a whole weekend plan around that, couldn't you, Bob? Thank you so much for coming in. Robert Speer is the president of the Kunia Orchid Society, whose annual orchid show will be held at the Leilua High School Gymnatorium the weekend of March 24th. And you can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Hi, this is Jason Taglianetti, HPR's Multimedia Production Manager. Did you know that we still use CDs for our music programs? Wonder what happens if a talk show guest starts coughing on the air? Do solar flares really interrupt news feeds? To all you curious, music-loving truth seekers who tune into HPR, thank you. Let us answer some of your questions and celebrate you during our upcoming Listener Appreciation Week. More information is on our website under the Events tab. See you soon.
And that's coming up next week. Now, you can see these signs across the state, and now the state legislature is considering how much to cap the interest payday lenders can charge for their services. Anita Hofschneider has today's reality check from Civil Beat.
Aloha, Bethan.
We have talked in past a lot about these payday lenders who charge exorbitant interest rates, you know, 459%, I think is the latest, and other states which have tried to cap them. What have they seen as a result of those caps? Do they in fact have an effect on the lender, on those who need the loans themselves, or do they simply just get used to whatever it might be and go with it?
Well, the results are mixed, but a recent article in Governing, which is a nonpartisan policy magazine, found that when payday lending was limited in Minnesota, consumers initially flocked to online payday lenders, but eventually stopped using them. So they eventually started getting used to using other options, such as borrowing from friends and family.
Which has its own issues, but you know, we're not going to go there for the moment. So what you're really saying is that in some ways people began to wean themselves off of these services because it wasn't something that they wanted to do anymore. That's not necessarily great news for the people who would like to keep them hooked to the payday loans. I can't imagine that those who are here in Hawaii are terribly happy about this idea of limiting the interest rate to 36%.
Yes, companies that do provide payday loans are really concerned about this bill from Senator Ross Baker, which would cap the rates at 36% annual percentage interest rate, because they say that that'll essentially drive them out of business. You know, especially when it comes to the cost of having a brick and mortar store with employees, providing health care, that type of thing. They say that they just wouldn't be able to make it work. And their argument is that if they go out of business, the consumers will, you know, lose access to this product because the people who come to them for payday loans tend to not have the credit scores to be able to qualify for loans from banks.
But after what you just said a moment ago about how caps have operated in other states, that would seem not to be true.
Yes, so consumer advocates and Senator Baker they say that now that these caps have been passed in 17 states as well as the District of Columbia, you know, consumers there are still able to make it work. They still are able to find loans through other means, and so they don't think it's would necessarily be bad for Hawaii to be able to cap this rate. In fact, they say it would be a good thing because consumers wouldn't be drawn to these loans, which seem like they are just short-term loans, two-week loans or a month-long loan. But in many cases, consumers can end up paying off the loans for months or even years, which is where the 459% annual rate comes into play.
Which is why so many social justice advocates have been saying that these things are bad news altogether, right?
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, we're going to see what happens with these with this measure and if, in fact, we see a cap on these bills, on the interest rate. Thanks a bunch. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Thanks for having me.
And Anita Hofschneider is a reporter with Civil Beat, today joining us with a reality check. Where and how vacationers want to enjoy their Hawaii holidays has changed, according to studies recently released by the Hawaii Tourism Authority. They're also fueling the disagreements over regulation between traditional hotels and homeowners offering travelers the choice of staying in a residential neighborhood. Earlier this week, I talked with Daniel Naho'opi'i, the Director of Tourism Research for the Hawaii Tourism Authority. We talked about one of the stunning results of the study showing that about 15% of those who were asked said they would not have made the trip to Hawaii had they not been able to stay at an alternative accommodation. I asked him how changed he thought the hospitality world really is in terms of tourism and individual choice.
Yes, that's one reason why we did those two studies. One was to look at how the demand for alternative accommodations is changing globally as visitors change their wants and their desires for, you know, a meeting, residents, having new experiences in the local area. And then also, is that actually impacting the residential housing and rental rates. So it has changed. Like you mentioned, 15% would actually not come to Hawaii if these other choices were not available, mainly because, you know, some groups are coming in, larger groups, family, multi-generation, and they want a larger place than they can get out of a traditional hotel room. Others are just looking, as I mentioned before, being in the neighborhoods, being a part of the people of Hawaii, and just experiencing day-to-day life as opposed to a coordinated tour or something.
Looking at whether or not there's an element of fairness with this, that, you know, your average B&B that has to be regulated in a certain way, and the idea that maybe, you know, those who are offering their home accommodation should also have to be regulated in that way too. Do we see those kinds of issues here as contentious as in other cities?
Well, first off, the Hawaii Tourism Authority, you know, has an opinion that we want to make sure that we understand who the various unit owners are so that we can ensure that the visitors have a safe experience, and also the quality of the accommodation that they're staying at is up to the level of a world-class destination as Hawaii. So we want to make sure that they're registered and we can identify them so we can reach out to them if there's issues such as a tsunami warning or such. And also that they're paying their fair share of the business taxes and other types of services.
Daniel, safety is one thing. I think there would be no disagreement that people would want to make sure that visitors coming to Hawaii would have a safe experience. I mean, in terms of general agreement. How that actually happens is another story. But the idea that everybody should be having a world-class experience, that's also very subjective. Is that really meant just sort of as a cover-all to be able to get at some of these other real issues, which is regulation and making sure that they're paying their fair share?
Yeah, I think the issue of paying their fair share, that's equitable, that we know what's happening in the business and we're not supporting any kind of illegal activity. However, I think when you talk about having various types of ownerships and such, that becomes an issue. I think that's what the study from AHLA had identified, that it's moving away from the independent owners and going to more large management companies or ownership companies or corporate ownership. And that kind of changes the experience itself, right? Since many want to come just to be a part of the residential area or being a part of living in Hawaii.
We've seen some legislation over a couple of sessions now that would seek to regulate Airbnb and similar type of the units that are listed. And last year, Governor Ige vetoed that. This year, the bill looks in some ways similar, in some ways different. How do you see this year setting up versus last year? And do you think that we're going to see some greater regulation, especially the fact that, you know, Airbnb is trying to convince them that they, in fact, are on their side?
That's a little difficult to tell right now as these bills start to shape up and are modified. But I think the studies that we did and some of the other studies that came out helped to educate both the legislators as well as the other people in the industry about what actually is happening on the ground and how those impacts can affect the tourism economy. You know, just to point out, this alternative accommodations industry or segment of our market has actually been here for over 20 years. In the past, it has been the vacation renters, vacation ownership homes, the condos. They were renting it and marketing it independently on their own, creating their own websites and a couple of management companies. And lately, it's been shifting to utilizing these global platforms like Airbnb, VRBO, and you know, even Expedia and TripAdvisor actually sell these kinds of alternative accommodations. So the overall industry hasn't changed much, and there's still a lot of options for people to rent out their accommodations. But at the same time, you know, it's not like it has been in the urban climates of San Francisco, New York, where there's a lot of illegal independent units fostering around there.
This also goes back into the idea of what rentals are available for people in Hawaii. None of these things exist in a vacuum.
Yeah.
Looking at how the number of short-term rentals have increased, and also the fact that, as always, we are still dealing with issues of affordable housing, Is there any balance that you see that would bring this better into a position to allow more affordable rentals for long-term use and get some of these things out of short-term use? Is there any balance to be struck here?
Well, our studies didn't really go into looking at that area of it, but we did identify that about 5 to 9% of Hawaii's residents currently are renting out either their primary home or a secondary investment property as a vacation rental right now. And then we also asked them, well, you know, are you going to continue doing this? And a lot of them said, no, not really. They're only doing it to help meet their financial needs, you know, subsidize their housing costs. So we estimate that it's only going to peak at about 12% maximum. So it's really not going to be the largest part. It's not going to dominate our accommodations pool. Now, in terms of affordable rentals, we also saw that rental rates have not increased as much as the room rates. So there's not a direct causal effect, but we did see around the resort areas, there has been some increase in terms of residential rental rates.
Some of what we've seen in and how these studies run, obviously you can choose to segment certain areas. How far around the residential areas and how far around the resort areas did you look? Because there's been some criticism that, in fact, it's going too far afield or it's narrowly looking at resort areas in terms of national studies that have been doing something similar to what you've been doing here in being able to get some true data, and Airbnb has been disputing some of that.
Well, our studies did go down to the zip code level. You know, a little complicated in the details, but in the study, we do have it by the various neighborhoods, and we do show the impacts of how many of these vacation rentals are in those areas compared to current housing units or, you know, the number of occupied units. There are some impacts in some of the North Shore or areas where they're more rural, where there's less housing, and so many of those are being used as vacation rentals as well. So it does vary by island and by neighborhood.
So where do you go from here in terms of the research that makes the case for how these vacation rentals should be brought into the fold and finding some way of being able to affect perhaps some compromise with people who say, hey, it's my house and I want to do what I want with it?
From this point, we'll be watching the various bills that are coming up in the legislature and helping them to work through meeting with our industry partners to hear their side and how it's impacting them, because even the hotel management companies are affected by it because various independent owners are actually pulling out of the hotel management companies and advertising on their own. So there's positive and negatives on both sides of the issue.
Do you think a compromise can be struck?
I think there can be. It has worked out in some destination areas, but it'll be, I think, a learning process. There'll be some trial and error as we go along and ensure. The bigger issue is right now we're only seeing some attempts at the state level, but really a lot of this issue has to do with land use, which goes down to the county level. So both parts have to work, both the state level issues and the county has to be working on their individual needs for their own residents.
Thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate the time.
You take care. Bye-bye.
Danielle Naho'opi'i is the Director of Tourism Research for the Hawaii Tourism Authority. HTA is the lead state agency on tourism.
Today's backyard quiz, we thought about a weedy tree that can grow out of control in Hawaii forests, an invasive that hogs all the sunlight with its 50-foot height and its broad leaves. Its seeds get spread around in animal droppings or on the boots of hikers, and stewards of the environment work hard to eradicate the troublesome plant. It was introduced to Oahu in the early 60s at Island Botanical Gardens and has since spread to the Ko'olau Mountains. A private nursery and botanical garden near Hana brought them to Maui in the 70s, and several East Maui infestations have since been reported. It's described as one of the greatest threats to higher rainfall forests and agricultural areas in the islands, and in 1992, The state declared it a noxious weed. Infestations in the islands are thought to be too widespread for effective chemical or mechanical control, and the State Department of Agriculture continues to search for effective biological control methods. If you spend any time in Hawaii's forests, you probably know about Myconia calvescens, or Myconia.
And Todd Crane certainly did. He called us from Kula and will be receiving the prize. It was a very popular quiz, thanks to everyone who called in, but Todd was faster. If you've got a backyard quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. And after we take a look at it, you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, helping strengthen the school-home connection with Home Edition, an online tool with reading and writing tailored to each student's ability. Achieve3000.com.
It's one of the most difficult challenges for the aspiring artist, drawing the human form. Classes in figure drawing require us to look at the human body with fresh eyes, understanding how it works and how it looks from the inside out. The great painters of history operated from a thorough understanding of anatomy, and their level of skill is in danger of becoming a lost art. But Maui artist Phil Sabato offers free life drawing classes once a week at his Wailuku studio. He's on the line to tell us about it.
Aloha.
Good to talk to you.
Well, I tell you, it's great to be here, being on your show and being able to present my life as an artist as an artist.
Well, Phil, what is it that makes the human body so difficult to get right?
Well, I tell you what, it's difficult. I remember going to school in California that I never learned anatomy drawing till about 3 years later and realized that you have to enjoy doing the human form first.
Yeah.
So I sketch a lot, and I love the human form. And from there, then I learned a little bit more about anatomy. And then I started realizing being here on Maui to start my own life drawing studio.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing it for 23 years. It's kind of like a community service that I do, where I have a lot of artists that come here, students especially, who's preparing for their AP portfolio.
Well, Phil, why is it so important to understand anatomy?
You know, that's an interesting thing that I think, you first of all, you have to enjoy drawing the human form.
Mm-hmm.
And first of all, that's what it is for me. A lot of my paintings are about the human form. And I need to understand not only the form itself, but the mood, the character of the individual, the purpose of the painting that I'm doing. So there's a lot of reasons, a lot of emotion. There's a lot of emotion done in doing a painting of a human form.
That's interesting, Phil, because the mood and character of an individual do reflect themselves in body language, don't they?
Correct. Yeah. In fact, like right now, I'm doing a commission, and it's about people who are in a hospital. How do you make the human form pleasing mm-hmm. for the humans who are or the patients who are there to make them feel at ease, that they're not afraid to be where they are, but to really bring them into the presence of who they are and to kind of bring in a stillness in them.
To show a kind of a relaxation and stillness then.
Correct.
And, of course, that expresses itself in terms of how the muscles are poised, posture, all those kind of things, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It has a lot to do about the expression of the face. The expression of the body form, has to be very relaxed, very soothing. The person could be in the water, just relaxing and enjoying nature.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing to me, Phil, how subtle body language can be, that the arching of an eyebrow can indicate a completely different mood.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And that is why drawing the human form is something that, you know, I have continuously been doing, because I've been doing it like for I'm 72 years old now, and I'm still practicing doing figure drawing.
Yeah.
And because it's a reflection. It's really about a reflection of me and my art.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to communicate.
Well, it would seem to do it right, to capture a mood, as you said, would require a certain amount of just insight into people. Never mind what your hands are doing. But
It's right? So true. A lot of times, you know, I hire models for some of my paintings,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of direct them, and eventually in directing a model, that eventually they kind of get the gist of what you're trying to say and do, that all of a sudden they'll just fall right into the mood that I want without me really directing them. So it's really a communication with the model that you're working with.
It almost sounds like a relationship of a theater actor and director.
Exactly. It's same thing. How are you going to say this word and with an expression on your face? And it's the same thing in painting. It's the same thing. How do you express an expression without really having to use words?
Because it's amazing how much people can understand in a nonverbal way. Of course, as an artist, you know that, right?
Oh. It's got to come from the inside, Chris. You gotta feel it to express it. And like you're saying, like an actor, you got to feel it to really express it. And this is what makes it so exciting about doing figure drawing is because, you know, as busy as my schedule is here, I do a lot of commission work. And I do a lot of murals, and I need to relax my mind. So I look forward to the Thursdays so I can do my figure drawing, because it puts me into that space of creating art in the purest form. And that, for me, that's drawing figures.
That sounds, you make it sound pretty exciting, Phil. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome. I really appreciate this opportunity, Chris.
Hey, my pleasure. Phil Sabato offers free life drawing classes every Thursday at 5 p.m. at Sabato Studios in Wailuku, Maui. In order to keep track of all the activities going on around our state, we rely on Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama for a look at events going on in our community that are under the radar. And Derek, this is an interesting one because this is a film director with a Hawaii connection.
Yes, he's an art director, Tombi Larson. He won an Oscar for art direction for the 1955 film The Rose Tattoo. Burt Lancaster was in that.
And Anna Magnani.
Yes.
Tennessee Williams.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was nominated for several others. His father-in-law was James Dole of the Dole Pineapple Company.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And he
Who
and his,
knew?
That's right. I had to look that one up.
Yeah.
And he and his wife moved to Kauai in 1961, and over the years, he explored the island, taking snapshots, which he then drew with colored pencils. And he called his exhibit 100 Entertainments, and you can see selected originals at the Lihue Public Library tomorrow at 6 p.m. with commentary by Bob Schleck of the Grove Farm Museum, and that's free.
It's amazing what you can do around these islands for free, isn't it?
I know.
There's another on the Alala.
Yes. There is a free presentation on the Hawaiian crow tomorrow in Hilo. The Alala is currently extinct in the wild and faces many challenges on the road to recovery. And you can learn more about the efforts to reintroduce this species back into the wild. And this is happening at the Mokupapapa Discovery Center in Hilo from 6 to 7 p.m. tomorrow. And it's free.
Yeah, I think we're down to just a few dozen raised in captivity.
Yeah, I know. It's pretty sad.
It is. Well, and here's a chance for aspiring musicians on Oahu.
Yes, you can enjoy a Kanikapila in Kapolei tomorrow. Sing and jam with Nahoku Hanohano Award winner Ku'uipukumukahi from 2 to 4 p.m. in the UH West Oahu Campus Center, room C. 225. And all students, faculty, staff, and community members are invited to this epic jam session. So I guess that covers just about everyone.
I can imagine once you get a couple of dozen ukulele and guitars in there.
Guitars and tambourines or whatever.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It all fits.
Conga drums, let's, you know, yeah.
And that's free tomorrow as well.
Great. Thanks, Derek.
Thank you.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community that are under the radar. And you can always find out more about them on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. It was gratifying, Beth Ann, to hear that Hawaii has a chance to really lead the nation in kupuna elder care. I wasn't entirely surprised because I know that is a big part of our culture here.
It would be nice to see Hawaii leading the nation and providing a model that could then be scaled and replicated in other places, in other states. The question is, will we actually avail ourselves of that opportunity?
Well, it is an opportunity because it's not likely to happen as much anywhere else, given all the cultural traditions that are kind of intersect here in the islands.
And given the size of our state and what could be done here, modeled here, you just use it as a learning lab and afterward begin to see how it might fit other locations too, where they don't have to reinvent the wheel either.
Yeah, I've seen there's a number of things in our state that because of our size and even because of our isolation allow us to kind of recreate the way things are done.
Well, that's a good thing, a good point on which to end.
It is.
And we're going to do that because we have to say goodbye, at least for the moment. We'll be back with you tomorrow, and at least I will, on Town Square. We're going to talk about tax fairness. Nicole Wu from the Hawaii Appleseed Center for Law and Economic Justice will be here. Also, retired business executive Randy Moore and Tom Yamachika from the Tax Foundation of Hawaii. And we hope you, too.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at our talkback line with your comments at 808-792-8217. You can always email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org or post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
And if you want to hear the show or another one, you can always take a look at our archive. That's on Hawaii Public Radio's website at, I just lost the website. Where did it go? HawaiiPublicRadio.org. Sorry about that.
I'm Chris Vander.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you tomorrow.